the seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras-Inglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable. And it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe torture. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam, and here's what's coming up.
Now you have another permanent member of the Security Council recognizing that the Moroccan plan of autonomy under its sovereignty is the only real basis for a resolution. So that is very, very significant.
That was Ambassador J. Peter Pham, former U.S. Special Envoy for the Sahel region, talking about France's decision to support Morocco's plan for the Western Sahara. Details coming up. Also, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has named her running mate in this year's presidential election, and Nigeria's protests over economic hardships continue. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. A short time ago, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris announced her running mate in the presidential election, and it will be Tim Walz, the governor of the upper Midwestern state of Minnesota. He was picked after an intense period of vetting potential candidates for vice president. The selection process appeared to focus on Democrats from so-called swing states, those that could swing between supporting the Republican candidate, former President Donald Trump, to backing Harris. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell is on the line with me now to tell us a little bit about who Tim Walz is and what he can contribute to the campaign. Anita, what does Walz bring to the Democratic ticket?
Thanks for having me on. Walz is a 60-year-old governor of Minnesota. He is an Army Reserve veteran, a school teacher, a legislator at the state level. And what he brings to the ticket is, balance. An appeal in these Midwestern states that have leaned Republican, and that's what he brings to the Harris ticket.
And Walz, as you know, he's a military veteran and also a gun rights advocate, and especially that might mean something in all of these rural areas of the Midwest. How important do you think that was in her selection process?
I think there were a lot of factors in her selection process. Obviously, that was one of them. I read a little bit about the vetting process. Usually, she didn't have much time for it, but usually it's a very extensive, very deep process. But this is definitely going to be a bit of a signal that perhaps a Harris Walz administration might not be as dire when it comes to gun rights as somebody else. So it's a signal, but I wouldn't read too much into it at this time.
Mm-hmm. And what are Republicans going to say now about Tim Walz, now that we know he is indeed the vice presidential candidate?
We heard from the Trump campaign shortly after the announcement. They described him as dangerously liberal, and they raised questions over possible fraud and wastage in a school feeding program. When he was governor, or as governor, rather, he recently unveiled a universal school feeding program for all of the children in Minnesota schools. It's not means tested. All children can eat breakfast and lunch at school, no questions asked. It's a massive program, and the Trump side is saying that it was very flawed and it was mired in fraud. But that's so far what they've come after him for. But these are early days, of course.
And it sounds like you're saying they're going to paint him as a far lefty, a left liberal.
He definitely has that reputation, even before this, for kind of drawing his state with these expansive kind of old-school progressive plans that have kind of drawn the state to the left. And so that is likely the tactic that they're going to use. But they also have to counter something that Walz himself coined, which is the term weird as applied to J.D. Vance, who is Trump's vice presidential pick. He's the one who first called Vance weird. And so I guess here he's kind of positioning himself as like a normal guy. And in terms of, you know, normal American, he's a six-year-old white family man with Army experience. He was a teacher. You can't get, I guess, in some ways, on the face of it, more normal than Tim Walz.
And generally, would you say, is the choice of a running mate consequential in U.S. presidential elections?
So I think that depends who you ask. We heard what Trump said about that the other day, and history does show that a lot of these picks are not remembered in history. I can't remember to save my life who Bob Dole, for example, chose as his running mate in 1996. So, I mean, yes and no. Obviously, Harris got a lot of attention when she was chosen as Biden's running mate because she was the first woman to be vice president, but it kind of remains to be seen. He is, I think, being seen as a pretty safe establishment pick from the progressive Democratic wing, and so it's he kind of just is ballast for Vice President Harris in her run for the presidency.
That is VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell. Anita, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
As you just heard in the U.S. presidential campaign, Democratic candidate Kamala Harris has announced her running mate, Tim Walz, the governor of the state of Minnesota. Republican candidate Donald Trump last month chose Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. Vance went to law school at Yale University, where he met his wife, Usha. She is a daughter of Indian immigrants who recently left her job at a top Washington, D.C. and California law firm. VOA's Dora McQuar has more about Usha Vance.
38-year-old Usha Vance entered the national spotlight when she introduced her husband, J.D. Vance, at the Republican National Convention.
I met J.D. in law school when he was fresh out of Ohio State.
The daughter of Indian immigrants, Usha Kilakuri was born in California and raised Hindu. She and Vance married in an interfaith ceremony in 2014.
I grew up in San Diego, in a middle-class community, with two loving parents, both immigrants from India.
Usha Vance's parents are academics, as is her great aunt, a physics professor in India, where there is a lot of pride in Usha Vance's accomplishments. C. Santima is her great aunt.
I felt very proud of the situation because from my family, such a great intellectual has risen means it is something.
P. Srinivas Raju is the former village chief.
The news, we got the news and we heard the news and we're very happy.
Her former law firm profile says Usha Vance participated in a media freedom access clinic at Yale. She also worked at an Iraqi assistance refugee project there. She clerked for both Supreme Court Justice John Roberts and for Justice Brett Kavanaugh when he was at the Court of Appeals. Anita McBride, who once served as First Lady Laura Bush's chief of staff, says people who know Usha Vance speak highly of her.
Super smart, very collegial, got along with everyone, and just is a hard worker and a nice person. And you want to hear things like that about people that are maybe in public life. You know, I think it says something about their character, okay, that they're well-liked.
Usha Vance's status as the child of immigrants could help voters from marginalized groups see her husband in a new light.
He adapted to my vegetarian diet and learned to cook food from my mother, Indian food.
Kelly Dittmer is from the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University.
She's validating and serves as a validator for him with potentially different communities who might not think that J.D. Vance would understand them or perhaps, support or advocate for them.
What can the mother of three expect now that she's been thrust into the national spotlight? Again, Anita McBride.
Really picking apart your background, your heritage, your education, the jobs that you've chosen. It's all now fair game.
J.D. Vance says his wife is, quote, not a very political person. She is out on the campaign trail with him. Mrs. Vance resigned from her law firm when her husband became Donald Trump's running mate. Dora McQuar, VOA News, Washington.
Nationwide protests over economic hardships continue in Nigeria for a sixth straight day. In northern Nigeria, Kaduna State officials have imposed a dusk-to-dawn curfew after protests turned violent and looting was reported there. The government blames the violence on those it calls hoodlums. In addition, police have arrested at least 30 protesters who were waving Russian flags, saying they violated Nigerian law. Our reporter in Abuja has been speaking with city residents for their perspectives on the protests. This civil servant, Tony Uche, backs the protesters.
Fully support the end bad governance protest that is going on. In fact, I wish it continues. Unfortunately, the reported killing of protesters by security agents has affected the momentum of the protest. You can see it's not like it was in the first 3 days. I can't really say whether it's because of the president's broadcast or infiltration of some unknown people into Abuja who are carrying Russian flags.
Real estate agent Michael Dodo says security forces have kept the heart of the city calm.
It has been ongoing, but not like it started from the 1st of August. Yesterday, we had news that the city gate and the 3M zone were mounted by security agencies to ensure that protesters do not go there. We also heard that just pockets in the Nyanya area, the security agencies were mounted there also to ensure that those guys, the hoodlums, and those who came from that area on the first day, you know, in their numbers, the crowd did not come again. So it's just been relatively peaceful.
And Vivian Ono, who is a fashion designer, is a bit frustrated with the problems that the protests have created.
As regards to the protest, I don't have much to say. Will things change? I don't know. Do protests bring about change? I don't know. Just for the inconvenience of not being able to move around, you being fearful of not meeting the protesters at the wrong time and at the wrong place. That's all.
That's Nigerians Vivian Ono, Michael Dodo, and Tone Uche. You can keep up on the developments in Nigeria on voaafrica.com and all your favorite programs. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV shows and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. The French news agency AFP reports that airstrikes have hit the Zamzam camp for displaced people in Sudan's war-ravaged Darfur region. The medical charity Doctors Without Borders reports that the Zamzam camp near the besieged city of El Fasher was shelled on Sunday night. An independent Sudanese aid group says the army used fighter jets to hit the camp, injuring at least four children. Aid groups have warned residents in the region are near famine. The camp's population is estimated to have swollen to 500,000 people due to fighting in that city. The conflict between the army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces began in April of 2023. Also in the country's north, heavy rains in Nile State have led to the collapse of several buildings in Abu Hamed, killing nine people. Last week, a flash flood caused the deaths of five people in Port Sudan on the Red Sea coast. France has thrown its support behind Morocco's autonomy plan for the disputed Western Sahara. In a letter to King Mohammed VI, France's President Emmanuel Macron called Morocco's 2007 proposal to offer the region limited autonomy under its sovereignty the only basis to solve the dispute over control of the Western Sahara. Some analysts say the shift deals a blow to the pro-independence Polisario Front, which represents many of the indigenous Sahrawi people of the region. It is also likely to anger neighboring Algeria, which backs the Polisario Front. Morocco annexed the Western Sahara in the 1970s as the Spanish colonial government ended. That sparked a conflict with the Polisario Front that ended in a United Nations brokered ceasefire, which promised there would be a referendum on the region's future status. No referendum has been held. Ambassador J. Peter Pham, former U.S. Special Envoy for the Sahel, discussed this development with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy.
I think that France's renewed support for Moroccan sovereignty is a very significant game-changing development. France, since 2007, has been supportive of the Moroccan plan of autonomy. But what's new in President Emmanuel Macron's letter to His Majesty King Mohammed VI was that France has adopted the position now that the plan of autonomy is the only basis to achieve a just, lasting, and negotiated political solution. And that is really quite a major position to be taken by not just any country, but one of the permanent five members of the UN Security Council following the United States, which under President Trump recognize Moroccan sovereignty formally. Now you have another permanent member of the Security Council recognizing that the Moroccan plan of autonomy under its sovereignty is the only real basis for a resolution. So that is very, very significant.
Algeria called Morocco and France colonial powers, new and old, and announced it would withdraw its ambassador from Paris, the foreign minister of the self-declared Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, Mohamed Sidati, accused France of acting at odds with international law and backing Moroccan expansionism as its influence wanes throughout the African continent. How could the French decision impact the stalled efforts by the UN to get the parties to discuss a way out?
Well, I think the French taking a position, one, I think it's the only realist position. Unless one is committed to living in a fantasy world or under a delusion, what the French have done is recognize reality. Reality is that the southern provinces, the so-called Western Sahara, have been successfully reintegrated into Morocco, participate in the life of Morocco as a nation, and there's very no likelihood of that changing. So France recognizes reality and seeks to encourage that realism as the basis and the only basis for a resolution. So I think it's very significant to have another permanent member of the Security Council take this position. So now you have two permanent members of the Security Council taking a very strong position here. And I think it's because it's a position that is consonant with reality, it's what's going to, over time, push, hopefully, to a resolution of this once and for all in conformity with the only result that is possible.
In June 2022, Algeria suspended a 20-year friendship treaty with Spain and imposed an economic blockade on the country when Madrid took a pro-Moroccan position on the disputed territory. The Spanish economy lost $1 billion American dollars in the following 7 months alone as exports to Algeria crashed. The French Socialist Party expressed its concern about the consequences of that decision and calls for diplomacy based on appeasement and dialogue. What prompted France to take this decision at this particular time?
Well, I think France has suffered us challenging several years in Africa, and it has seen, I believe, the need to recalibrate its relations with Africa. And part of that recalibration includes doubling down on its partnerships and dealing with reality as opposed to perhaps its own delusions that have plagued it in the past. So I qualify this decision on the part of France as, above all else, its conformity with reality. And France is also in a much different position than Spain was vis-a-vis Algeria. For French exports, Algeria is not even in the top 10 markets that France deals with, whereas France itself is the number 3 market for Algeria's exports. So Algeria may recall its ambassador, but an economic boycott would be self-defeating on the part of Algeria.
That's Ambassador J. Peter Pham, former U.S. Special Envoy for the Sahel region. He was speaking by phone in Washington with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shenawy. The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, or IFRC as it's known, is appealing for urgent life-saving support for tens of thousands of landslide survivors in Ethiopia as the country braces for even more disasters. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Ethiopia is no stranger to landslides, but the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, or IFRC, says the number of people known to have died from a series of landslides at the end of last month make these the deadliest in Ethiopia's known history. Paula Fitzgerald is the IFRC head of country delegation for Ethiopia and Djibouti. She says at least 243 people have died, among them 30 pregnant and lactating women, in landslides on July 21st and 22nd. Speaking from the capital, Addis Ababa, she says the region continues to face severe weather. She warns the ongoing heavy rains increase the risk of further landslides.
And there's reports coming out that there's been another event in another area of southern Ethiopia just in the last overnight. So we're trying to find out more information about that. The rugged terrain makes rescue and recovery operations difficult. There's also the risk of diseases spreading.
The IFRC reports nearly 300,000 cases of malaria have occurred in the southern regions of Ethiopia so far this year, and more than 300 cases of measles. Fitzgerald warns dire conditions in the landslide areas are likely to boost those numbers. She describes the landslides that struck southern Ethiopia's remote Gofar zone as devastating and says more than 15,500 people need to be relocated urgently. So far, she notes, around 3,600 people have been moved to safer areas and plans are underway to relocate 2,900 more shortly.
The needs are immense. Vulnerable groups such as children, pregnant and lactating mothers, the elderly, people with disabilities, and students who've lost their families urgently need support. The ERCS has been providing food, non-food items, and essential household goods, but more help is needed.
The IFRC and Ethiopian Red Cross Society launched an emergency appeal for $7 million. Fitzgerald says the money will provide life-saving aid and early recovery activities for 25,500 of the most vulnerable landslide survivors. Besides providing immediate relief, she says both agencies are committed to seeking long-term solutions, focusing on health, livelihood recovery, and disaster risk reduction in the most disaster-prone areas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We have our VOA sports analyst and host of our Olympics podcast, Chasing Gold, Mukbil Yarbrough, on ANT today. Thanks for being on the show, Mukbil.
Thanks for having me, Carol.
So, the women's 5,000 meter had a ton of drama. Can you fill us in on what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. Kenya's Faith Kipyogen, who was expected to do really well, and she did. She ended up finishing off with a silver medal, but was initially disqualified because of, I believe, a pushing or shoving incident that occurred with the Ethiopian Sigai.
Allegedly pushing, right?
Initially, they had disqualified her for that, and that's what they were saying it looked like to them. But then after Kenya's Olympic Committee basically, you know, appealed it, they took a closer look at it and reinstated her silver medal. So kudos for her. When I looked at an initial saw it, it just looked like, you know, very unintentional. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that she's back on the podium, as she is a huge name in long distance running. Running for not only for Kenya, but for all of Africa.
And so maybe that was just an honest mistake.
It definitely seemed like it. It didn't seem like it was malicious from my, you know, my humble opinion when I was watching it.
So staying with track, more developments have come out about the women's 2,000 meter sprint. What can you tell us?
The
sprint.
Yeah, the 200 meter. Yep. As for the 200.
Did I say 2,000? 2,000. I meant 200.
That's a really long sprint, right? The 200 meter sprint. We have the Jamaican, who is the world number one, Sharika Jackson, has just pulled out as well. So initially she was supposed to try to go for the double. She was supposed to participate in the 100 meter as well as 200 meter, expected to potentially double. She could have won both competitions, but due to a lingering hamstring injury, she pulled out of the 100 meter, which was earlier on in the week. She was expecting to maybe be able to be fit enough to compete in the 200 meter, which is her specialty, but she found out that she is not well enough to do it. It's really sad when you see an Olympic athlete work for so long, for 4 years, not able to compete in both of her sprints, especially when you were expecting to podium. So really, really sad.
Yeah. What about men's Olympic soccer? They will have an African team on the podium this year. Who will it be?
Yeah, absolutely. So Egypt and Morocco both lost in the semifinals. Morocco lost to Spain 2-1. And then we have France losing, France beating Egypt 3-1. So Morocco and Egypt will go up against each other for that bronze medal. So one of those two teams wins means one of an African nation will be on the podium for this year. So
exciting,
huge accomplishment, absolutely, for sure.
Coming up for some Olympic Africa teams. That's great.
We're always hyped.
Yeah, and that wraps it up for this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Vandy, and our engineer, Atreus Regis, and for you, Muckville, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.